This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. For 7 years now, Tiger Woods had never missed a cut. But yesterday, remarkably, he botched a crucial putt. And so today, while other golfers do what golfers do, young Tiger will do something else. 142 is what his streak of cuts accomplished comes to. It was great. The longest live streak now is Sorenstam's. It's 48. The Professional Golfers Association of America released a statement late last night indicating that round three of the Byron Nelson Classic at Cottonwood Valley will commence as scheduled today. A real World Series wouldn't be limited to teams based in North America. A real World Series would feature clubs from a representative collection of the nations in which baseball has become competitive and popular. But, of course, a real World Series would be impossible because Major League Baseball's owners wouldn't want their employees playing hooky from their big league responsibilities and risking injury in an international tournament. So how to explain the news this week that Major League Baseball itself, that bastion of Doubleday Double Talk, has approved the World Baseball Classic, which would greatly resemble a tournament actually deserving of the moniker World Series? Joining me now to help explain this veritable grand slam of a development is Kevin Baxter, who writes about baseball for the Miami Herald. Kevin, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
How did baseball get past the traditional argument against a tournament like this, namely that players could risk injury in an event that won't make major league owners any money?
Well, I think this is really Bud Selig. He really wanted this for a number of years. He's been pushing for it. I think the commissioner is a little bit concerned about his legacy at this point, and this is part of that. He's really wanted this for a number of years. This has been in the works for a while. There were a number of hurdles he needed to clear, and he got past most of those. There are some really big ones that will have to be negotiated between now and March, but it looks like we're going forward with this finally.
Well, tell me about some of the hurdles that still need to be jumped over.
Well, one hurdle, I think the biggest one to me, is the whole idea of the drugs again. This will be an international tournament under the auspices of some international organizations, and they have asked that the World Anti-Doping Rules, the WADA rules, will apply to this. Now, those are slightly different from baseball rules, even under the new policy that baseball has adopted. So it is possible, it is conceivable, that a player could be tested for this tournament, fail that test, and still be eligible to play under Major League Baseball rules. That would be a huge public relations disaster, both for the player and for baseball. That's one thing. There's another thing that Major League Baseball teams cannot block a player from going. For example, if Sammy Sosa wanted to play for the Dominican, the Baltimore Orioles could not stop him. There is a rule, however, that each player on a national team has to be approved for the tournament by Major League Baseball. And what they're going to try to do is stop one team from losing all 25 of its players to this tournament so they wouldn't have anyone in camp at spring training.
Right.
There are going to be some players that want to go that are deserving to go, whose countrymen went to see them on that team, and just logistically it's going to be impossible for everyone to go. That, I think, is another little bit of a problem.
Well, there is at least one player who they won't have to worry about on that score. My very favorite reaction to this so far came from Pedro Martinez. When he was asked if he'd like to pitch for the Dominican Republic, he said, quote, "No, only if I have to." Now, there's national pride.
Well, I think you're going to see some of those things change, and I think there'll be a lot of pressure to bear on him at home. You know, he went back 2 summers ago to participate in the opening ceremonies at the Pan American Games, and that was a big deal, and I think he will be there. But there are some other players that raise some interesting possibilities. Alex Rodriguez, for example, was born in New York to Dominican parents. He could participate for the U.S. as a U.S. citizen. He could participate for the Dominican Republic as someone who has Dominican heritage. The same thing with Manny Ramirez, who is a nationalized U.S. citizen. He could participate for the U.S. or for the Dominican. What are some of these players going to do? It's going to be very interesting to see how some of those things play out, because someone's going to get their nose out of joint a little bit, no matter what teams these players choose.
Baseball came up with a nice round number of countries invited to participate in the World Baseball Classic. 16 teams broken into 4 groups of 4, but I understand that at least one of those 16 may very well not participate. This, of course, is Cuba. Why wouldn't they play?
Well, the Cuban issue is a big one because, again, you know, as you said in the intro, this is supposed to be a World Series, and one of the things that everyone's wanted to see is how would the Cuban team do against professionals? They had the home-and-home series with the Orioles. They played very well, but that was a very bad Baltimore Oriole team. These are Major League All-Star teams, not just from the United States, but from a lot of different countries. The Canadian team, for example, will be much stronger than people think. The problem with the Cuban team is Cuba has been able to beat up on Team Sweden and the assorted collegians that the U.S. sends to international tournaments. they haven't really played the best players in the world yet. And Cuba gets a lot of propaganda value out of their international domination of baseball. If they were suddenly to go to this tournament and lose to Panama in the first round, which would be very possible, that would sort of hold up to the light that the Cuban team perhaps hasn't been as strong as we've been led to believe all along. That's one problem. I think another problem is the revolution was founded, and one of the first things they did was ban professional sports, boxing, baseball, everything else. Mm-hmm. To go and play against professionals, I think, would be a philosophical problem for the Cubans. And finally, Cuba's participation in the tournament could cause some problems for the U.S. The second round of the tournament is supposed to be at spring training sites in Florida and in Arizona. Now, if the Cuban team were to make the second round, we know they can't come to Florida. The public outcry would be so huge that it would disrupt the tournament. So they would have to go play in Arizona. There's just a lot of logistical problems that Cuba's participation could raise. But I talked to two officials in Major League Baseball yesterday, and they are adamant that they want the Cuban national team. They don't want a team of defectors. They don't want a team of Cuban Americans. They want the Cuban national team here. They feel like their participation is important to make this tournament what it's supposed to be, a big tournament matching all the best teams, and without Cuba, that won't happen.
Well, let's assume that Major League Baseball prevails and that Cuba does participate. You've mentioned Canada being perhaps stronger than people might think. Puerto Rico would have to be considered a good one. Japan, Australia. Are we talking about a tournament that the U.S. very well might lose?
Oh, yeah, because it's going to be a tournament where, my understanding is the later rounds will be single elimination, so you can run into a hot pitcher, and that could be a real problem for you. Imagine the U.S. team going up against Johan Santana of Venezuela. That could be a problem. The other thing to think about, too, is there will be pitch counts so that a team such as Venezuela can't use Johan Santana every game and then send him off to the Twins and say good luck this summer and the guy has a dead arm. So there will be pitch counts. So it will be important to see a pitching staff such as the Venezuelan staff, which will have Freddy Garcia, Johan Santana, Carlos Zambrano. They'll have a tough pitching staff. What I think is interesting is seeing these great pitchers all on one team, or seeing a double play combination. For example, the Dominicans will have Miguel Tejada and Alfonso Soriano, mm-hmm. and a Japanese outfield of Hideki Matsui and Ichiro. That's the kind of stuff that I think is going to be exciting to see.
Kevin Baxter writes about baseball for the Miami Herald. Kevin, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you for your call.
A few hours before the Baltimore Orioles play the Chicago White Sox in Comiskey Park this evening, Baltimore's third base coach, Tom Treblehorn, and several other members of the coaching staff will stride onto the green expanse of the outfield, each equipped with a baseball. After a few minutes of negotiation to decide who goes first, Treblehorn, batting coach Terry Crowley, coach's assistant Orlando Gomez, and batting practice pitcher Rudy Arias will engage in a competition that embodies the staff's determination to refrain from taking itself too seriously. Before a ball game 3 weeks ago, Tom Treblehorn explained the happy ritual.
The game is what we call baseball bocce. It is established by throwing a girls' weighted softball to an area, and almost like horse calling a shot, then closest to the ball wins that hole and gets to call the next one. And we play to 12 or 15, depending on what it is. We get exercise, and we get on each other's nerves in a beautiful fashion.
Baseball bocce looks like fun, and I wondered if the players, most of whom are just sitting around in the clubhouse watching TV or playing cards when Treblehorn's game begins, ever ask to join in.
We do not allow the players. We see plenty of the players during the course of the season. We don't need to see them out here early playing with us.
At least in the early going this spring, the Orioles players don't seem to have been brooding about their exclusion from the bocce games. While the Yankees, they of the high expectations and highest payroll, stumbled through April and have only begun to bunch wins together in May, the lightly regarded Orioles jumped to the lead in the American League East and have played well enough to hold on to first, despite the best efforts of last year's champs, the Boston Red Sox. Speaking in mid-April, Tom Treblehorn, who managed the Milwaukee Brewers and later the Chicago Cubs during the 90s, said that he regarded spring victories as welcome and useful.
I think winning now puts you in a position where, you know, you should be in better shape come May 1st. And then you take care of May, you should be in better shape come June 1st. You take care of June, you'll be in better shape come July. And as it goes through the entire season, where you don't have to make this mad crash rush at the end of the year.
For the past several summers, even a mad crush rush wouldn't have helped the Orioles. The Yankees and the Red Sox have dominated the division, but this year's start by Baltimore has changed the way some of the Orioles are thinking about the summer. Veteran relief pitcher Todd Williams, who joined the Orioles last season after stints with the Dodgers, Athletics, Reds, Mariners, and Yankees, knows how fragile a team's psyche can be in the spring.
I think if you struggle from the beginning, there's a lot of finger pointing or maybe a lot of questions that want to be answered when it all could just be a case of just getting off to a slow start, you know. But we've gotten off to a good start, which is great for us because not only do we think we are, you know, we can do the job, but now we know that we can compete and we can do well. So for us to start out good is definitely a great benefit.
B.J. Surhoff, the 40-year-old outfielder now in his second tour with the Orioles, likewise values this season's early jump on the Yankees and Red Sox, but for less profound reasons. He says putting on a uniform each day is just more pleasant than it would otherwise be.
People talk about having fun or this and that, and you know, fun a lot of times relates to winning, you know, how much fun you have. You're always going to have fun at the ballpark, but it's a heck of a lot more fun to be winning.
For their nightly infusion of joy, the Orioles and their fans have recently had to start counting more and more on Surhoff, who has been part of the collection of outfielders replacing the injured Sammy Sosa since the former Cubs slugger left the lineup a week and a half ago with an infected foot. Baltimore's pitching, which had been unexpectedly solid through April, has also become a little spotty over the last couple of weeks, and the Orioles have not fared as well out west as they have nearer home. Still, in a division that has recently been the sole property of the Yankees and the Red Sox, the Orioles, even the ones who are coaching rather than playing, are, according to Tom Treblehorn, thrilled to be competing rather than squinting to keep the division leaders in sight as they sprint toward the summer.
It makes right now much easier to come to the park every day. Looking in the standings makes it easier. And if you stay healthy and are consistent, you got a chance to do what we did in 96. We went wire to wire in our division. We were one call in New York from a guy reaching over in the stands, interfering with a fly ball, from maybe being the World Series that year. So I don't care when you are. It's good to win. In early, late, middle, it don't matter.
Following Tom Treblehorn's customary game of baseball bocce this afternoon, the Orioles will try to enhance the team's fun quotient by beating the leaders in the American League Central Division, the White Sox, in Chicago tonight. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up, Harvard helps the big kids anticipate life after football. But first, in order to write his new book, Sunday Money, Jeff McGregor spent most of 2002 immersed in the noisy world of NASCAR. From Daytona to Phoenix and New Hampshire to Alabama, accompanied by his wife as photographer, McGregor followed the rolling thunder of the race cars and lived among the fans. He's sufficiently recovered to join me now from New York. Jeff, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you so much for having me, Bill.
The NASCAR season runs 40 weekends with very few breaks. Did you know what you were in for when you took on this project?
Had no idea. It begins as all terrible crackpot schemes begin with a simple conversation. I was talking to the guys at Sports Illustrated, and this is mid-2001, and we thought, well, there's a phenomenon here, clearly, that we have yet to address in a meaningful way. So why not go out and do a piece? And then some smarty jammies pipes up, why not do two? We'll do one about the racing and one about the culture. Mm-hmm. And then someone piped up yet a third piece, and the next thing I knew, I was living in the Walmart parking lot.
Much of the first part of Sunday Money is description of the various challenges that you faced driving your temporary home from track to track. Was living in a mobile home the only right way to research this book?
I thought so, and I'll offer a gentle correction. Mobile home is the thing that gets carried off in a tornado. a motor home is what we were stuck in, our tiny
motor
metal box.
And I shouldn't laugh at tornadoes and mobile homes.
No. 30 years from now, you're going to know all about this way more than you care to when you're trying to find a good spot to park next to the course in Tucson. we really thought about, is there a way to do this? And there's a huge motorhome culture in NASCAR, unlike any other sport. At Daytona for the 500, the first big race of the season, those folks have been out there for over a month in some cases. So the guys at Lambeau Field who scream how they've been out there since 11 in the morning have got nothing on these folks.
Fairly early in Sunday Money, you characterized the attitude of NASCAR fans toward their heroes by writing, quote, "Carry us with you, we're saying, and do us proud. Remember us. Make us better." Is that an attitude peculiar to NASCAR fans, or is it something they share with fans of all athletes in all sports?
That's a great question. I think that in other professional sports, the attitude persists, but perhaps there isn't the opportunity to offer the gesture. It's very hard to get a glimpse of or get an autograph from your favorite NFL star or your favorite baseball star. These guys are available generally, for 15 seconds, the length of time it takes to walk from the locker room to the bus after the game. But in NASCAR, it's a lot like country music. Mm. There's not just an encouraged, but an almost enforced relationship between the drivers and the fans.
Of course, there is a dark side to this relationship. At a track in Pennsylvania, you witnessed a most dramatic demonstration of how fast a fan's admiration for a driver can sour. Tell us the story of Dale Jarrett and the two men rooting for him.
Well, I can only sketch it out schematically, as you know, because, again, the FCC has big, big ears. Dale Jarrett had just won the race at Pocono. And an oddity of Pocono, and there are many, but one of the oddities is that there's stands built up above Victory Circle there, and these two young men who were decked out in their Dale Jarrett UPS gear were standing above him shouting down into the noise and celebration of the post-race, and they clearly loved him very much. They admired him a great deal. But over the course of the next 5 minutes, Dale Jarrett never responded to their calls. He never looked up. He never turned to them. And in the course of that 5 minutes, you saw the entire arc of celebrity worship in America. You know, it begins with "You the man, Dale," and ends with "We made you," in a very angry, angry way. And it was just such a telling moment for me.
Dale Jarrett refused to validate them on that occasion. That's what came to me from the passage.
I think so, but in Dale Jarrett's defense, he may not have even heard them.
Right.
There is no place louder in America than a racetrack, even when the cars are shut off. You've got to remember that between the confetti cannons and the 95th playing of, you know, the studio remix of Freebird, it's just deafening. I, you know, my wife and I now can only speak to each other when we're in the same room. Yelling from one end of the apartment to the other doesn't do any good because our ear bones have been ground to a powder.
You characterize one event at the Texas Motor Speedway as follows. The race is loose and rhythmic, with an accident every 50 laps or so to keep the fans in it. How would the average NASCAR fan feel about that description?
I think it depends on a fan's willingness to see NASCAR honestly. I'll say this. This is my disclaimer. Nobody goes to the track to see anybody get hurt. I think fans, though, very much enjoy, as did I, the idea that you could completely wad up a $200,000 race car, see it towed off the track, dripping fluids, useless, broken, and then see it reappear the next week. I think there was something very cathartic in that. I mean, if you live anywhere but New York or Boston or Chicago, or cities where there's a reasonable mass transit system, you have this terrifying love-hate relationship with your car. Mm-hmm. You love having it, but you're also terrified that something's going to go wrong with it. And I think this is a way for us to project our passive-aggressive loathing of our automobiles.
Jeff, NASCAR likes to promote itself as a sport that is at least as popular as any other sport in the country, but you argue that this contention requires the use of some pretty creative counting. Why is that?
Well, when I first heard the numbers, NASCAR's claim to 75 million fans, that seemed to me to indicate a little bit of optimism on their part. I mean, if you do a push poll where you cold call folks at home and say, "Have you ever heard of Richard Petty?" You could probably classify them as a NASCAR fan if it was in your best interest to pump up the numbers. But then I heard things like, it's the highest per event attendance rate of any sport in America. If you take that per event attendance rate in NASCAR, 186,000 people per event, it's mind-boggling. But then you multiply that by 36 events, you wind up with about 6.7 million people have gone to NASCAR races. Whereas baseball, who tends to take the beating whenever NASCAR makes the comparison, put through the turnstiles last year 67 million people.
Mm-hmm.
I think the other area where NASCAR plays a little fast and loose with the numbers is in their television ratings. They compare their one weekly network broadcast to Major League Baseball's one weekly network broadcast. But we all know that everybody watches baseball on a local or regional or satellite basis. Something on the order of 30 million people a week watch baseball on television. And at a normal NASCAR race, middle of the season, you're going to get about 6 or 7 million viewers for that. So again, NASCAR is just doing what any business does. They're trying to put their best foot forward and sell their commercial time. I just think that their assertions needed some common sense fifth grade math, which is really all I possess.
At several points during Sunday Money, you recognize that NASCAR, that the phenomenon of NASCAR has implications beyond the sport of auto racing. Would you please read from page 332 in the book?
Sure, I'd be happy to. You could see the next war in it even then, hear it coming a year before we pulled the trigger. You couldn't miss it, even if you didn't know which way to look or which war we'd fight. There it was, all around you in the honor guards and the booming flyovers, the bellicose benedictions and the defiant music and the thundering fireworks, hat over your heart for the anthem and standing razor straight, no matter how drunk you were or how cynical or disaffected. You were swept along by it, swept up in it, unquestioning. It was like seeing the American flag for the first time some weekends and 100,000 throats tightening with pride or sadness or mother love, love of country and love of freedom and love of horsepower and of Walmart and Junior and Tony and little Mark Martin and every other thing. And before you knew it, your eyes were wet with patriotism and your heart bent to every loss and went out to every 9/11 widow and sank for every corrupted American body on every battlefield since first Manassas. And sweet Christ, the firefighters and the cops too, gone, the heroes of every boomer's second grade reader. Gone in the endless instant playing over and over on the national video loop, that fire blooming again and again, and the black smoke flowering, and the buildings and all those people falling. You couldn't get any of it out of your head, even if you wanted to.
It sounds, at least in that passage, as if you found yourself becoming part of something that was going on, something you were there to witness.
Oh, sure. I don't know that I'd say we went native. But at some point, you are borne along by that great American parade. And that was sort of the book, as it turned out over the course of that season. It had begun as this sporting survey of NASCAR, and it turned into this sort of cultural overview of a very wounded America in a very strange time in its history.
Jeff McGregor is the author of Sunday Money, Speed, Lust, Madness, Death, A Hot Lap Around America with NASCAR. It's published by HarperCollins. He spoke to me from New York City. Jeff, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure.
Really, quite honestly, all they had to say was Harvard, and that carries a lot of weight.
From a high school senior, that assertion would come as no surprise. Spoken by a guy about to enter his 14th season in the National Football League, it constitutes an intriguing proposition. Kendall Gammon, the long snapper for the Kansas City Chiefs, is one of 33 pros and former pros who have been learning various non-contact skills at the Harvard Business School this week. Gammon, a silent partner in a nursery business, jumped at the opportunity to return to academia.
I was happy to get to a place and try to learn more about a small business. I have a small business, and I knew I needed to learn more about that. I know right now, I know enough to know I don't know enough, and I puppy dog around a lot, and the only way you learn things is to be around it.
Kendall Gammon has also been learning things this week by examining case studies with other football players in the company of professors, discovering through dialogue the difference between a business opportunity and a money pit in a program jointly sponsored by the National Football League and the NFL Players Association. Though lots of players get involved in small businesses and other investments while they're still employed by NFL teams, the transition to life beyond the camaraderie of the locker room and the roar of the stadium crowd can be very difficult. A recent study suggested that 1 in 4 players reports financial difficulties in the first year after retirement, and that within 2 years of leaving the game, 78% of the players are unemployed, bankrupt, or divorced. These dark numbers perhaps encourage the exploration of ways to better prepare players for life after football. Stacy Robinson, who played for the New York Giants when they won Super Bowls in 1986 and 1990, is now the director of player development for the Players Association. He approaches his job with a veteran's understanding of how hard finding a goal beyond football can be.
You have to understand the realization that there's going to be nothing that you can do that'll match that same type of adrenaline that you get from playing football. But I do think your life has to be filled with another passion. I think part of the reason guys have difficulty with transition is they get into things that they have to get into. They get into it because, you know, it's just a job to pay the bills or, you know, to get on with that next stage of life, versus really finding something that they're really passionate about that they don't have to watch the clock.
One of the player students who arrived at the Harvard Business School with a passion in mind is Reuben Brown. Drafted by the Buffalo Bills in 1995, the 6'3", 300-pound offensive guard played last season for the Chicago Bears. His interest in motorcycles has led him to explore the possibility of one day owning and managing a Harley-Davidson dealership. Reuben Brown smiles when he discusses the incongruity of Harleys and Harvard, but he maintains that whether he's selling choppers or widgets, it's all business. 10 years after he last attended a class at the University of Pittsburgh, Brown says he's learned more about how to learn.
I was a football player, happened to be going to school. Classes were a requirement so I could get on the football field, so that's what I did, so I could end up playing sports.
Do you see yourself now as a more earnest student than you were then?
Oh, definitely more so now. I have the patience that I didn't have before. You know, after making it to the NFL, there's nowhere else to go. There's no Olympic football team. You know, so this is it. This is the pinnacle of what we've been striving for since a young age. And now that that goal has kind of materialized, it's only natural for me to be curious about what's next for me.
It's a good thing for Reuben Brown that he's a better student at Harvard than he was at Pittsburgh. The curriculum of the business program in which Brown is enrolled is crunched into two sessions of just 3 days each, one in April, one in May. Dahani Jones, whose business interests include developing real estate and selling bow ties, and who is currently employed as a linebacker for the Philadelphia Eagles, says he would only recommend the Harvard program to players who are committed to its rigors.
You know, it's not necessarily an easy program. You wake up every morning at 7 o'clock and you have a class from, you know, you wake up at 7, eat breakfast by 7:30, you have class from 8 to 9, and then 9 to 10:30, and then 10:45 to 12, and then a working lunch from 12 to 1:30, and then you have group meeting from 1:30 to 1:45, then you have another meeting 1:45 to 2:30, then you have a 3 o'clock meeting until 5, and then you have a break for 2 hours that most people work out, and then you have dinner, which you sit with the professors and discuss more things. So then you get back into your room about 10 o'clock, and people have discussions till about 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock in the morning, and then you're up in 5 hours. So it's not necessarily a program in which people should lollygag.
By all accounts, nobody in the current program is lollygagging. In fact, Professor Carl Kester, the senior associate dean at the Harvard Business School and faculty chairperson of the NFL Business Management Program, says that while Jones, Brown, Gammon, and the rest may initially have been intimidated by Harvard's reputation, they very quickly learned to join in the give and take of the case study method and started challenging their professors.
They are competitors, first of all. They're serious. They set high standards for themselves. They meet those standards. In a sense, they've got all the raw ingredients it takes to be successful in business if they really want to make the effort.
The program at Harvard and a similar curriculum at the Wharton School in Philadelphia are currently serving just 65 current and former NFL players. But both Mike Haynes, Vice President of Player Development for the NFL, and Stacy Robinson of the NFL Players Association expect their joint effort to grow. There may be a side of Reuben Brown that wonders if expansion is such a good idea. Talking to him these days about how he plans to discuss what he did on his summer vacation when he arrives at training camp, you get the sense that he likes feeling kind of special.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. All of my friends are, like, amazed by this. You know, they're like, wow, look where you're going. You know, I've been to the Pro Bowl. You know, I've been to the playoffs. You know, they seem to be more fascinated about me coming here than my accomplishments on the football field. You know, it's exciting. I kind of poke my chest out a little bit. Like, yeah, I've been to Harvard.
Harvard. 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, by dairy farm families from Massachusetts and throughout New England who own Cabot Creamery, five generations making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, cabotcheese.com. And by Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting, available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, a literal political race. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a consideration of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Chris Herzog is my candidate for luckiest person connected, if only peripherally, to sports. He's the guy whose lost Kentucky Derby ticket, which was worth $864,253.50, was found and returned to him. I understand that you lost your ticket, too, but it doesn't matter.
I lost my ticket because I threw it out a window, and it didn't land where I thought it was going to land. This was, the famous superfecta,
mm-hmm.
where a $1 bet would net you almost $865,000. The ticket seller, proving once again that the only honest people are at the racetrack, is the person who came to the rescue.
The second round of the NBA playoffs has provided some surprises, not the least of which is Seattle's 2-1 lead over San Antonio. Is the Sonics' first round near sweep of Sacramento looking a little bit less fluky to you?
You mean the Seattle Supersonics, who I dismissed from the playoffs almost before they began?
I wasn't going to remind our listeners of that, but go ahead.
Yeah, they've managed to get, in the most recent game, they managed to get San Antonio tangled up in a 90-point game, and they shot very well. Rashard Lewis and Ray Allen didn't even score in the fourth quarter. But they got San Antonio tangled up in ugly ball, and they managed to win when Tim Duncan missed a shot.
On the other hand, the Miami-Washington series is pretty much following form. The Heat currently enjoy a 3-0 lead, and Shaq is resting all of his muscles except for one, the one controlling his tongue.
He's having a great interview series. Meanwhile, my friend Dwayne Wade is carrying the ball club. My favorite quote of the most recent from the big Aristotle is that he says, "I've been playing like Eric Dampier." No, Shaq, you've been playing like Bill Walton. You've been playing like George Mikan. You've been playing like Bob Foothills Kurland, which is to say, you haven't been playing at all.
Many observers feel that Shaq, and not the Phoenix Suns' Steve Nash, should have been named the league's most valuable player. Are you dismayed or outraged that the MVP went to Nash?
Again, as I've said often on the show, there are two arguments I never get involved in. Actually, 2.5 arguments, because one of them is pretty much the same. Who should be in any Hall of Fame? And what does the V in most valuable player really mean?
Mm-hmm.
What does valuable really mean? I also don't argue about who should win or lose the Heisman Trophy. Look, Steve Nash had a terrific year. There's a case to be made for Shaquille O'Neal every year. His numbers are down this year from previous years. Of course, that has a lot to do with the fact that he's playing with another superstar in Dwayne Wade that he actually likes. But, you know, you want to give Steve Nash the big trophy and whatever incentive bonus was in his contract, I have no problem with it.
I hesitate under these circumstances to even bring up that Nash's coach, Mike D'Antoni, was named NBA Coach of the Year. Good selection?
Oh, yeah, that's an absolutely terrific selection. I hope at least some people will see it as a reward for him for letting his players run and jump and dunk and have a good time playing the game and not jamming them into the paint. This is a team that was 62-20 this year. D'Antoni, about whom people knew very little, had a terrific season. I hope people look at this and say, maybe we should play this way, too.
Houston Rockets coach Jeff Van Gundy was fined $100,000 for his comments about NBA officiating. A group of NBA refs have gone public in their demand to have Van Gundy fired. They're not satisfied with a mere fine. Wouldn't it be more cruel to let him keep coaching and suffer a lot of bad calls for as long as he continues?
You can be facetious about this, but you really do have to wonder what the Houston Rockets are thinking right now. Because you're right, he's not going to get a call. If I'm Yao Ming, I'm very unhappy with what my coach is up to. This whole thing, and now Jeff Van Gundy is saying that when he referred to an NBA official, people thought he meant a working NBA referee when he was really meaning an official with the league or something. He's digging himself a deeper hole. I don't know if he can survive through this. I mean, this is one where if you have the gun, produce it. Otherwise, you shut up.
Two other big losers in the world of the NBA are the brothers Goodwin, Aaron and Eric. They used to be the agents representing LeBron James, but he fired them this week. The Goodwins had secured LeBron $135 million in endorsements. Who's going to do better?
Well, they got 10% of that or whatever, so they're doing pretty well themselves. This bodes ominously for the person reputed to be the star of the next millennium for this league. He's brought in a friend and a former high school teammate named Maverick Carter to be part of the team that's going to take over as his agents. This does not bode well. This smells in a gentler way like like Mike Tyson firing his original corner team and bringing in a bunch of schmoes who wave magic beans around. The high school friend's name is Maverick Carter. Undoubtedly, his brothers Sugarfoot Carter and Gunsmoke Carter will be along for the ride.
The commissioners of Major League Baseball, the NFL, the NBA, the NHL, and Major League Soccer will all testify before Congress next week. Given James Toney's recent woes, shouldn't Don King be summoned as well?
Toney's story is very strange. You know, you don't normally think of boxers really as part of the ongoing steroid crisis, although if you listen to the people pumping the ongoing steroid crisis, everybody up to and including the House Judiciary Committee should probably be tested. The real drawback to all of this, of course, is that it will put John Ruiz, the world's most unappealing stylistic boxer, back in the title hunt for another year.
2 weeks ago, Tony Pena, then managing the Kansas City Royals, received a vote of confidence from Royals owner David Glass, and I guess Tony should have started packing right about then.
Why do they even bother? I never understand why owners, at this point in history, when we all know what the dreaded vote of confidence means, why do they do it? Why don't they just fire the guy? You know, you were 58-104 last year. You were 8-25 starting off this year. We have enormous confidence in you for the next 10 days.
Exactly. Those inclined to pretend that the National Hockey League still exists were delighted to hear that Wayne Gretzky may become the head coach of the Phoenix Coyotes. The next-to-last paragraph of the article regarding that possibility reads, quote, "An immediate coaching decision is not needed," which is rather the point, isn't it?
Why doesn't the NHL just name, you know, Spider-Man to coach a team or you know, Ashton Kutcher or somebody? We're going to put 11 billion people in our stadium. The NHL is a...
Britney Spears will sing.
It's a virtual league now. They can do anything they want.
Absolutely. Fans of the Philadelphia Eagles will be delighted to learn that Donovan McNabb, the team's quarterback, said this week that the Eagles can win the Super Bowl with or without Terrell Owens. Let's see. How many Super Bowl wins would that give the Eagles?
They couldn't win it with them last year. It does put the Eagles a little bit thin at wide receiver since they dismissed the relatively useless Freddie Mitchell earlier this week, and Terrell Owens wants to renegotiate, which they're not going to do. Actually, I think he'll be back playing this year.
The Yankees have finally started to win some baseball games, but the team is still hauling Jason Giambi around with the extra bats and rosin bags. Wouldn't it be better for everybody, Giambi included, if he agreed to play in the minor leagues until he either recovered his swing or decided that under the current steroid paranoid conditions, he's simply unlikely to recover it?
I don't know what's going through his head right now. He's out there on a limb all by himself in this whole steroid frenzy. I think baseball-wise, absent everything else, you know, the logical thing would be for him to go to Columbus for a while. But you don't know what going to Columbus means in his head right now. You really don't. I mean, does it mean he's given up? Does it mean he's now, in his own mind, he's a pariah? It's an interesting time in history to be a baseball player.
Proving that the world of sports extends to just about everywhere, the baseball card of Pope John Paul II is now available on eBay. Aren't you glad you saved your Pope Urban VIII rookie card, Charlie?
I just wonder if before the conclave opened, they had them all in a little room off the Sistine Chapel having their baseball cards taken. You know, at spring training, there's always a day where the baseball card guy comes. And they all pose with bats next to walls. Or they do get in their fielding stance, and they get their pictures taken. I just have this vision of this line of Cardinals, you know, in blessing stance, having their photo taken for the Topps rookie set.
And finally, Charlie, a German team beat a U.S. team in a soccer competition in Atlanta earlier this week. The score was an unremarkable 2-0, but there were some remarkable elements to this competition.
Well, I'm going to stay away from pointing out that having robots play soccer is redundant because this was robot dog soccer.
And the U.S. couldn't even win that.
It's terrible. Why? How have our robot dogs fallen so far behind the rest of the world? There was a time where we led the world in robot dogs. Sure. How in God's name, what is wrong with America?
It's a robot dog gap. It's obvious.
I can't believe. When did they get ahead of us? Who sold our robot dog technology to the Germans?
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me outraged each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Bill. I'm shocked. Shocked to learn this. I don't know.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. This week, even as the U.S. Senate quibbled over the president's nominee for United Nations ambassador and the House debated the Gang Deterrence and Community Protection Act, some rakish pals with a penchant for fitness and fun took to the D.C. streets for a political race of a different kind. From the nation's capital, Rachel McCarthy reports.
It's 6:30 a.m., and Jeff Darman surveys the scene at Anacostia Park near downtown Washington, D.C. He's got dozens of volunteers setting up tables, unpacking boxes of supplies, and checking the sound system that will soon be announcing the names of some of the nation's most influential leaders.
One day of the year, I get to have the high and mighty down here, and I give them some orders, and they run around in their underwear, basically.
Darman is the director of the ACLI Capital Challenge, a 5K charity race, which attracts teams headed by more than 30 members of Congress, as well as a slew of executive branch agency leaders, federal judges, and members of the media. Darman came up with the idea for the race, which benefits the D.C. Special Olympics, early in the Reagan administration. The goal was, and still is, to show the American public their busy and serious leaders still have time to stay physically fit and have fun. Humor is evident everywhere in the race, starting with the porta-potties that line the route. Each door has a different sign: Senate, House, Executive Branch, 2008 presidential candidates, to name a few.
The first year we did it, what was a little alarming is we realized people were standing in line. There'd be a toilet with nobody in line, and there were some with four or five people in line. We realized they were obeying the signs. People were actually standing in the appropriate line instead of just using the first available toilet. But I think people have finally learned that it's supposed to be funny.
The toilet signs are a long-standing joke. But Darman also works hard to make sure the participants get a dose of new humor each time they come to run.
We have a lot of topical signs so that each year, depending what is the topic, we'll make fun of it. I mean, we've got signs here that say, want the judges to please move to the finish line without delay.
Darman's not the only one with a sense of humor here. The teams also get their creative juices going as they compete not just for first place in the race, but for best and worst team name. Republican Senator from Texas, John Cornyn, used his team name this year to state his political aspirations.
Our name is Not Running for Governor, and that's because I'm not running for governor in 2006. Our team name this year is better than our one 2 years ago, that My Cornyns Are Hurtin', which got the award as the worst team name, which I think was well deserved.
This year's candidates for best and worst include Senator Bill Frist's team, Follow the Leader, Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison's The K Team, and CBS News, Rather or Not, Here We Come. Also on the list are Hearst Newspapers' Running Till It Hearst, the Army's Army of Run, and Fox News Channel's Fair and New Balanced. The event's atmosphere helps foster camaraderie and draws runners back year after year.
I've done this race before, and I think it's a lot of fun and a very good thing for our nation's capital. This is one place where you can actually witness bipartisanship.
Democratic Representative Jane Harman, leader of Team G.I. Jane.
People don't hit each other, not in my experience, and they don't trip each other. They actually cheer for each other. Imagine, that would be a first in this 109th Congress.
Harman is on the other side of the political aisle from Texas Senator Cornyn. But the two agree on the importance of breaking down those barriers.
The truth is we work hard, and we sometimes fight hard in the halls of the Congress, and so it's nice to come out and just do something together where we leave all that behind, at least, you know, for the next hour.
But just because these politicians look forward to an hour or so of bipartisan fun doesn't mean they can't take their training seriously. Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa.
As a senior runner, obviously I don't run very many miles every morning, usually two. And so in the past races, the third mile was always the toughest for me. So the last 3 months I've been running 3 miles so that I'd be able to get through this race without suffering.
Senator Grassley wants to repeat last year's win over fellow Republican Senator John Cornyn. That's right. Forget partisan politics. The fiercest rivalry in the race may be between members of the same party. Senator Cornyn issued a pre-race warning of sorts.
Senator Grassley, yeah, he's a very competitive kind of guy. But I told him, I said, well, if you were a freshman senator, wouldn't you let the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee beat you in a competition? And I just sort of left it at that. Last year I beat him by 3 minutes, and I never let him forget it. So he's been training for the last year because he said he's not going to let me beat him again.
With the gauntlets thrown, the only thing left to do is actually run the race. Once the race starts, goodwill still abounds, but many runners are quiet and focused on the run. After all, pride is on the line. The over 600 runners are greeted by their supporters as they cross the finish line.
And with a wave to the hat, let's welcome Dave Hoffman.
Internal Revenue Service Commissioner Mark Everson comes in with an impressive time of 21:11 while wearing race number 1040. And, no surprise, last year's overall team winner, Navy, wins again.
Senator Chuck Grassley coming across the finish line now. Good job.
Finishing under 28 minutes, Senator Grassley wins first place for captain in the over 70 division.
Well, it was tiring, but I felt better at the end than I did a year ago. And the real joy of winning was beating John Cornyn by 1 minute and 40 seconds.
Senator Grassley pauses for a smile and a brief moment of celebration. Then it's back to business.
All I can say is it's easier to run this race than it is to get a Social Security bill passed.
For Only a Game, I'm Rachel McCarthy in Washington.
A reporter from the Pentagon Channel. Good job.
We'll meet again, don't know when. Don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Daryl Hannah at Splash Studio. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to browse Only a Game's show archive or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Stacy Robinson, Director of Player Development for the National Football League Players Association.
When you talk about player development, you're talking about the development of the player.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, from NPR member stations, from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from Vision to Innovative Impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org, and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.